WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. A court rules that a newly elected member of Shenandoah County's school board can keep his seat. Governor Spanberger signs her first bills, sending four constitutional amendments to voters. And we talk with our February Books and Brews guest about his new novel, which explores a world newly shaped by chatbots, autonomous cars, and other non-human forces. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, February 9th. A panel of three judges ruled last week that Mike Scheibe was properly elected to the Shenandoah County School Board, and a prior felony conviction from Pennsylvania does not prevent him from holding that office, WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
L.M. Mike Scheibe II won a seat on the school board in November, but did not disclose a prior felony conviction or the date of his restoration of voting rights on a candidacy form. His opponent, Brent Wilson, challenged the election in the local circuit court. In Thursday's opinion, the judges wrote that Wilson did present evidence that Scheibe signed a plea deal in 2004, admitting to felony criminal trespass and misdemeanor possessing instruments of crime on December 24, 2003. WMRA confirmed this conviction through a criminal record check from the Pennsylvania State Police. To qualify to hold public office in Virginia, someone must be qualified to vote for that office. Pennsylvania felons, unlike those in Virginia, automatically get their voting rights back after being released from incarceration. The judge's opinion says a plurality of states permit those convicted of a felony by another jurisdiction for an offense not regarded as a felony under the laws of the prevailing state to hold public office. A felony conviction out of state without any further evaluation, such as for equivalence, only precludes the right to a firearm. They said an out-of-state felony's impact on the rest of a person's civil rights in Virginia is an entirely open and perhaps unexamined question. But they note the Pennsylvania felony Scheibe pled guilty to most closely aligns with a Virginia misdemeanor of unlawful entry. As to the form on which Scheibe did not disclose the felony, he previously filed a demurrer which argued that an alleged false statement wouldn't make him ineligible to hold office. A person may be ineligible to hold public office upon conviction of a felony for making such a false statement, but Scheibe has not been charged with this crime. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
You'll find our previous reporting on this case at WMRA.org and on our app. You can learn more there. Governor Spanberger has signed the first legislation of her administration, Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
The official signature of Her Excellency the Governor of Virginia is now on four pieces of legislation. The first bills she's signed into law since the inauguration last month. All four are constitutional amendments that will be going to voters later this year. First up, an amendment to remove Virginia's defunct ban on gay marriage.
Ensure that every family knows that Virginia is a place that welcomes them, appreciates them, and sees them for the wonderful family and Virginians that they are. So before I get too emotional on that one, I will start signing.
That was just the first signature. She also used the ceremonial pens to sign legislation that could lead to voters approving amendments protecting abortion rights and voting rights. And then there's the proposed constitutional amendment to implement a new congressional map designed by Democrats who run the General Assembly to unseat four Republicans in Congress.
I have endeavored to be a partner to them, ensuring that any map they choose is one that can be implemented. And as that is the largest of the constraints for me, this map meets those parameters. And so if they choose to move forward with this one, then I don't intend to stand in the way of that.
Voters will consider the amendment to draw new congressional districts in April. The other three amendments will be on the ballot in November. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Spanberger has picked a well-established leader in Virginia healthcare policy to lead the state's Medicaid program. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that the governor has named Steve Ford as director of the Department of Medical Assistance Services, DMAS. Virginia's $24 billion Medicaid program serves nearly 2 million Virginians who are poor, elderly, or disabled. Ford is a former deputy director of the agency under four governors, three Democrats and one Republican. The Virginia House of Delegates has approved a slate of gun control bills over the objections of Republicans. The measures include new storage rules civil penalties for leaving guns in unattended vehicles, and a ban on assault-style weapons. The proposals are now headed to the Democrat-controlled Senate. Governor Abigail Spanberger has vowed to sign legislation that would strengthen state gun control laws. Former Governor Glenn Youngkin vetoed similar bills in prior sessions. In the wake of President Trump's crackdown on immigration, state Democrats want to limit federal immigration enforcement in Virginia. Five such bills survived committee votes last week, and Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner has the details.
Federal immigration enforcement may get more complicated in Virginia if a group of bills passed in a House Delegates Committee Friday get signed into law. The five bills are now headed to the chamber floor. One limits where ICE can detain people, including courthouses and other public locations. Another bans law enforcement from wearing masks and requires they identify themselves in most cases. Another limits local police from aiding ICE unless they have a judicial warrant. One more makes new penalties for impersonating federal agents. And the last one empowers the Attorney General's office to punish those who try to scam migrants. The need for these bills was highlighted by immigration advocate Paulina Chavez, heard here at Friday morning's meeting through a translator.
It's affecting many families, even the children, as when the parents see the police, they think, oh no, this could be immigration, and it's affecting their children's access to school, to education, to food.
Public Safety Committee Chair Delegate Marcus Simon said the bill still had some work to go and agreement with Senate versions before they hit Governor Abigail Spanberger's desk. But immigration advocates like Luis Aguilar with CASA said it was a step in the right direction.
Right now, in a time when we have seen federal enforcement, specifically ICE, really terrorize communities, we have seen state legislators notice this, draft legislation, and advance it forward.
The bills passed along party lines in most cases, though the scam prevention bill had nearly unanimous support, with only one Republican voting no.
Employees for local government may soon be able to engage in collective bargaining if a bill makes it through the General Assembly. Michael has the details.
Republicans accuse Democrats of wanting to raise taxes on everything from Netflix to dog walking, but one of their top concerns is a bill that would allow public employees to engage in collective bargaining. Here's Republican leader Ryan McDougal.
One of the bills that is absolutely going to cost Virginians more money. It is just a death knell to the hoax of affordability, and that is collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is elimination of right to work for all government employees.
The bill to allow public employees to engage in collective bargaining was filed by Democratic Senate Leader Scott Surville, who says Republicans are trying to make people believe that the sky is falling.
The only thing collective bargaining requires is for people to get together and talk. It does not require people to agree to salary increases or benefit changes or anything. Everything that is in the collective bargaining agreement has to be approved by either the General Assembly with funding or with the local government with money. So the idea that it forces salary increases is utter nonsense.
Surville's bill has cleared the first hurdle, passing out of the Commerce and Labor Committee on a party line vote. The next stop is for it to be considered by the Senate Finance Committee before moving on to the Senate floor. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
In 2024, the U.S. Supreme Court okayed the use of criminal penalties for homelessness. Recently, an effort to block Virginia localities from doing so was killed in a House of Delegates subcommittee. Brad has the details.
The U.S. Supreme Court found, quote, the enforcement of generally applicable laws regulating camping on public property does not constitute cruel and unusual punishment. And according to the Virginia Housing Alliance, more than a dozen localities across Virginia currently criminalize loitering or homeless-adjacent activity in the wake of that decision. Kashish Pillai is with the progressive group New Virginia Majority.
Currently, Virginia does not have enough beds to meet the needs of more than 7,000 individuals experiencing homelessness statewide. Yet current law allows people to be penalized for basic survival activities when they have nowhere else to go.
Fredericksburg Delegate Joshua Cole tried to ban such local ordinances last year. The bill was sent to the Housing Commission, a group that meets between sessions to craft bills. And so Cole came back with the bill again this year, but
there's been a motion with the second to continuing this bill to 2027 with a very serious letter to the Housing Commission.
Sheila Herlihy Hennessy is with the Virginia Interfaith Center. Her group advocated for the law change and was disappointed by the committee's delay of the effort, but she's staying optimistic.
And the Housing Commission does have new leadership, a new director, so it is, I think, hopeful that we might see different results.
There are no meetings for the Housing Commission on the calendar yet, but Delegate Cole said he hopes to bring the bill back with their support in 2027. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Virginia musicians netted Grammy Awards in the spoken word, country song, and alternative jazz categories recently. But the influence of performers from the Commonwealth stretches back much further. Virginia Public Radio's Dave Cantor has more on the impact of one musician from Southwest Virginia.
Texas Gladden said she knew more than 100 songs, tunes she'd learned from her family, which had been in Virginia for seven generations by the time Gladden was born in 1895 in Saltville. Independent scholar Aldona Dye, who took part in a recent Encyclopedia of Virginia conversation on Gladden's work, said her interpretations of traditional ballads are still resonant.
Her style of singing and, just her as a singer is sort of held up as the example of what, Virginia ballad singing sounds like.
A handful of performers have worked to pass along Gladden's influence, including Joanna Newsom, who included a take of Three Little Babes on an album in the early 2000s. Here's a bit of the original. Gladden, who died in 1966, didn't record, perform, or tour regularly, though she appeared at the Whitetop Folk Festival throughout the 1930s, as well as at the 1938 National Folk Festival. And while she lived long enough to hear the beginning of the mid-century folk revival, Gladden wasn't swept up into the fervor, despite Joan Baez recording a rendition of a tune associated with the Virginia singer for her 1960 debut. I'm Dave Cantor.
Finally today, Charlottesville author and UVA English professor Bruce Holsinger explores a world newly shaped by chatbots, autonomous cars, drones, and other non-human forces in his latest novel, Culpability. He's our guest for tomorrow night's Books and Brews at Pale Fire Brewing in Harrisonburg at 7. WMRA's Chris Boros asked Bruce why he chose to center the novel around technology.
I would talk to so many different people who in the industry, in the AI space, industry leaders, people working in tech on the legal side, and everybody has what's called a P-doom number, a percentage chance that AI will kill us all. So, I laughed about it for a while, but I do. Yeah, I'm worried about what this world looks like. I think it's a world of tremendous opportunity, but tremendous change. And we're all in for some surprises, I think.
When you were writing the book, did you deal at all with how, we personally are using artificial intelligence and sort of how we have a responsibility and how we're using this technology?
Yeah, well, the book is, it's a story of a family. They get in this really awful accident in a self-driving car at the beginning of the book. And everybody in the car believes themselves responsible in some way. So in some ways, the whole theme of the book is about our collective responsibility, how we deal with the various levels of responsibility between ourselves and the world, humans and machines. So yeah, the book is very much about those kinds of moral questions.
And one of the characters in the book, Alice, she has these long conversations with the chatbot. Can we go to say that she's addicted to this thing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's one, Alice is the middle child in this family and she doesn't really have any friends. And her dad sees her at one point, her dad, Noah, and Noah's the one telling us this story in the novel. He sees her lying on the couch texting with somebody. And he says, so who are you texting with, sweetie? And she says, my friend Blair, I met her at the hospital, after the accident. And Noah just thinks, oh, that's great. Finally, she has a friend. And it turns out Blair is the avatar for a chatbot that Alice invented on an app. And she has this very addictive, very unhealthy relationship with this bot. And as I was researching the novel, I looked at all kinds of examples of this, you know, people really worried about their kids, other young people getting too invested in these bots, which can be very affirming, which can, you know, make them feel good and friended, but also, you know, have it play a big role in self-harm across all ages. So, yeah, that's something that really worried me that I wanted to get in there.
And it's so easy to prompt AI, you know, these days too, to write something. So I'm kind of curious, in your world as an author, are you concerned about AI, you know, taking over your job as an author someday?
Not so much my job. You know, Culpability is my fifth novel. I'm in my 50s. I also teach English at the University of Virginia. I'm less worried about the creative arts than I am about just basic reading and writing, K through 12 and university levels. We're all concerned about how these machines are substituting for critical analysis, for critical thought. You know, the process of putting together words into sentences, sentences into paragraphs, paragraphs into pages, you know, those processes of writing and then reading, taking apart sentences, really breaking things down, those go back thousands of years in human history. And suddenly this feels like a technology that is threatening those processes and threatening that form of thought and expression. So that's the thing that worries me most about AI, or at least in its large language model form.
I was going to ask you about your work at the University of Virginia, where you teach English. I'm kind of curious, how do your students use AI in the classroom?
You know, in the first year or so that ChatGPT was out there, we were all just kind of, it was like a tsunami hit us. Like we suddenly, so many students were turning in papers where they were using these things. And there weren't rules against it initially. And then everybody just got very paranoid. They started implementing absolutely no AI policies. There were all these plagiarism accusations. Now, I think we're settling down into, if not a consensus, you know, different sorts of solutions for tackling the problems in different ways. Like, for example, having a non-digital classroom where students are reading from hard copy, writing by hand, writing in class, so that we're not substituting large language models for writing, but instead we're giving them an opportunity to do, you know, more analog forms of writing. It's not, I would say, reactionary. It's not conservative. It's more allowing students to explore AI in spaces that are built for that rather than in spaces that aren't. We're trying to preserve AI-free, somewhat tech-free spaces. In some ways, maybe AI gives us a new kind of opportunity for that.
Charlottesville author Bruce Holsinger talking about his AI-themed novel, Culpability. He's our guest for Books and Brews. Tomorrow night at 7 at Pale Fire Brewing in Harrisonburg. To hear a longer version of the interview and to get details about tomorrow's event, visit WMRA.org or WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Monday.